Skyscrapers in Houston, like most skyscrapers, are places where janitors and the people whose offices they clean are kind of like ships passing in the night.
Just hello in the elevator.
Hello, how you doing? Fine, thanks. Bye.
They keep different hours, often speak different languages, so the distance between janitors and office workers makes sense. But it's weird, too. Every day they walk or vacuum the same carpet. They breathe or deodorize the same air. They even look at or dust the same pictures.
This is my grandbaby, her mom and dad.
¿Ellos hacen lo mismo que yo?
That last voice is Lorenza Delgado, a janitor at Wells Fargo Plaza in downtown Houston. She says when she sees those photos of smiling families on the desks she cleans, she smiles. Thinks to herself, the people who work at those desks, they're just like me.
They love their families, and they're working to provide a better future for them. That's why they keep them close.
Delgado's sitting in her hot, tiny living room in one of the poorest neighborhoods in Houston, and every surface is covered with pictures of her daughter, 6-year-old Leonarda, two above the couch.
Leonarda, Leonarda.
A bunch more perched on a little table.
Leonarda, Leonarda.
Leonarda at her preschool graduation. Leonarda standing next to a model rocket ship.
Muchas Leonardas.
Delgado runs through those images every night on her commute to work. 2.5 hours round trip by bus. But her family, her childcare issues, that stuff didn't come up in the quick interactions she'd have with office workers while she was cleaning. Until a few years ago, when she met a woman on the 53rd floor.
Erika.
Erica Vasquez. I'm an administrative assistant. The first time I met Lorenza, I was working a late night and she came around to, you know, take out the trash. So I just started talking to her.
Vasquez speaks Spanish, but their conversations had to be brief. With so many offices to clean, Delgado literally runs through the halls to get it all done. Still, in passing exchanges, little things have come out that give Vasquez a better picture of Delgado's life. Take the recyclables everyone thought the building was sorting. Turns out, Delgado was collecting them.
She would take the cans and get money for the cans to at least pay a bill or something. The amount she makes barely pays enough to pay the rent.
Not to mention food or school supplies or Delgado's diabetes meds. The $12,000 that Delgado makes a year is well below the poverty line for a family of two.
It's not fair. They work so hard, get paid so little. I don't know how she does it.
Vasquez tried to get Delgado a higher-paying job cleaning rooms at a hospital, but there wasn't a good bus route there. As for Vasquez's bigger question of what's fair when it comes to pay,
no, you're best. No,
that's exactly what striking janitors like Delgado are trying to get office workers in Houston to think about. They've been holding daily marches in front of towers owned by companies like Exxon, Shell, and J.P. Morgan Chase. They say if Houston's corporate skyline is booming, why are they paid so little?
There was a demonstration outside my window. It was quite loud.
Drew Wellner is a lawyer who works in a downtown skyscraper. He's gotten to know some of the janitors who work in his office.
They're very hardworking people. They're always very nice. But I don't know that cleaning the offices of people who make more money necessarily correlates into what they should be making.
But for most of the 20th century, that's how it worked, according to University of Massachusetts economist Aaron Dubay.
Used to be the case that regardless if the person was a CEO or the person who cleaned the CEO's office, when the company was doing better, everyone tended to do a little bit better. That has changed.
One of the main reasons that's changed, Dubay says, is this. Today, if you're a janitor, you probably don't work for the owners of the building you clean. Instead, you work for and collectively bargain with subcontractors, national and multinational cleaning companies, all vying to be the lowest bidders for their customers, the buildings.
You end up becoming hired by a middleman. That makes it easier for, let's say, a building owner to not have to pay higher wages when their profits are doing pretty well.
Which brings us to another conversation a janitor recently had with not exactly the person who works in the building she cleans, but the CEO of the company the building is named after.
Mr. Diamond, thank you for appearing today.
J.P. Morgan Chase is the third biggest owner of buildings where Houston janitors work. And last month, the man who runs J.P. Morgan Chase happened to be testifying before Congress.
I think you've made about $19 billion in 2011 thereabout. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
In a union publicity stunt after Jamie Dimon's testimony, a janitor named Adriana Vasquez walked up to him. She cleans J.P. Morgan Chase Tower in Houston, and she says she had a question.
Mr. Dimon, you make the billions of dollars every year. Why do you deny the people cleaning your buildings a living wage?
Diamond told her to call his office.
Call my office.
She's still waiting to hear back. When I called Chase and the other major building owners in Houston to ask about janitors' wages, I got answers like this.
Hey, Chrissy, this is Greg Hassel at Chase calling you back. Don't have a comment for this one.
Chrissy, hi. Patrick McKinn calling with ExxonMobil. We're really not interested in being in your story at all. We don't like getting involved in things that we don't have anything to do with.
I mean, you know, at a certain level, does Jamie Dimon know what that person is making? Of course not.
Here's Aaron Dubay again, the economist. He says Chase, Exxon, the other companies that dominate the Houston skyline, it's not like they're directly dictating the terms of janitors' pay, but they hire the contractors who do. And there's another simpler way that Chase's and the Exxons of the world are connected to the janitors.
Every employee, including their CEO, presumably needs to use the bathroom. And when they go into the bathroom, it has to be clean. This is a very basic necessity that is filled. You know, they can't work in an office overrun with trash.
When I work in the floors, I always look in the pictures and I'm always imagining, wow, there are so many happy faces.
A janitor named Hernan Trujillo started cleaning offices soon after graduating from high school to help pay for his mom's medical bills when she got sick. And when he looks at the photos on the desks he cleans, there's one that always gets to him.
The one that it's always making me sad is, sorry. The kid is graduated from college. And, sorry. That was one of my parents' dreams.
That's why janitors in Houston are striking, Trujillo says. If they got paid even a little more, enough to make ends meet and save a bit at the end of the month, it's the sort of thing that could maybe help families like his send their kids to college, like in those pictures on the desks he cleans. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace. Celie Niehaus woke up one day with a spending hangover. She was in her late 20s at the time and in deep, deep credit card debt, $10,000, half her annual income. The hangover was especially brutal for her since she was, well, she was an officer at a bank.
Had been in financial services for many years and knew better and still made the same mistake that many consumers make. Too much consumption, had a little too much fun, got myself in debt, and of course at the end of the day you have to pay it back.
As a banker, Celie was well-versed in the mechanics of paying off debt. Reduce spending, increase revenue. First, she worked on the reduced spending part. Went on a shopping freeze, stopped going out to eat.
I started walking to and from work.
The raising revenue part, that was a little trickier. Her job at the bank was full-time and salaried.
So I couldn't work extra hours at the bank to increase my income, which led me to the second job. I was fortunate enough to know some people that worked for the Fayette County school system, and they had told me about a janitor's job.
She took it. 5 nights a week, 4 hours a night.
I learned a lot about cleaning, believe me.
50 offices every day.
Empty their trash cans, vacuum on my hands and knees to clean the table. The glass would need to be fingerprint free. The mopping, that's not an easy job.
Then one day she was rushing back from her banker job in her business suit.
Trying to get home, change my clothes.
When she ran into a woman who worked in the school administration offices she cleaned.
She made eye contact with me.
Celie waved at her, said hello.
She looked at me. There was no recognition. And I said, it's Celie.
Then Celie thinks, oh, right.
You don't recognize me without my garbage can. That's when she realized that I was the janitor.
The woman asked why she was dressed so nicely, and Celie explained the whole situation. By the time she got in for her janitorial shift that evening, everyone who worked in the office seemed to know about her secret life as a banker.
As I went from office space with my garbage can and vacuum, they would start asking me financial services questions, questions about loans, questions about debt. When I left, they gave me a going-away party, and someone had said, they've never given a janitor a going-away party.
It took Celie 2 years to pay off her credit card debt. Today, nearly 20 years later, she's a vice president at E-Trade. In her spare time, she teaches young people about personal finance. She uses this story as a lesson. Looking back, she says, there's no shame in taking a ground-level job to get yourself out of money trouble. She hopes maybe those office workers she met as a janitor learn that lesson, too. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
When the Robert Taylor Homes opened in 1962, Chicago Mayor Richard Daley channeled the high hopes of a new urban generation.
This project represents the future of a great city. It represents vision.
I was 11 when my mother moved us out of a rat-infested flat and into the Robert Taylor homes. It was a big step up. New appliances, heat, and well-kept gardens. But without tending, good intentions rot. Now it's sort of fresh, and we're standing in this field, and you smell fresh-cut grass, actually. But what you used to smell is meatpacking houses, this awful wet blanket smell of dead animals. And in the summertime, that was oppressive.
Where's the interest to this place?
But across the street today, it's a family reunion, a picnic for people who grew up in the first building of the Robert Taylor homes.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Hey, Tommy.
Glad you came out, man.
My old friends like to make a fuss when I come back. I got out. I moved up. There's a certain neighborhood pride that comes with that.
That's family there.
Tommy Hamilton was still a kid when I left.
To see three and four generations of families down here, it brings joy to my heart.
It's not uncommon for three or four generations to grow up in the same housing project. But with a boost from affirmative action, I graduated from a mostly white New England prep school. My ticket to Harvard, a career, economic mobility. Most black men born into poverty stay there. Some manage to climb up a step to working poor. But people like me, still the exception, even after the city bulldozed the projects.
When they tore down these buildings, and the ones that got displaced say they probably took the project mentality with them into the other neighborhood.
My oldest friend, Steve Stewart, knows a thing or two about project mentality. He got a scholarship to prep school just like me. But the pull of the projects can be strong. Steve dropped out of Northwestern University halfway through his junior year. Now he moves from one hood to the next, gentrification hot on his heels. He likens the movement of project people to the reservation system and Native Americans.
The Indians were here at this place, and now they have to be replaced because you need their place. When you take away someone's residence and say, well, now you have to go here, you hope it's for the better, but they got the worst situations.
Steve had a chance, and he blew it. But he says no one should really be surprised.
You follow your people's footsteps. If your daddy's a lawyer, you might want to become a lawyer because you see all the law books. If he's a doctor, you might want to do that because, hey, doc comes in and lets you know this is a nice profession. This is what you want to have. But if you're poor, you're used to poverty.
His new home is in a hood called Terrortown on the far south side. Yeah, that's T-E-R-R-O-R. And despite the name, some of the neighbors are pretty friendly.
So if I look out this window, will I be amazed at what I see going past me every day?
Yeah, it erupts.
How often do you hear gunshots?
I heard gunshots yesterday.
Charles Ross goes by Slim. He's in his 30s now. And turns out, he spent his childhood in the same projects as me and Steve. But Slim says that's no reason to just give up.
I stay in this neighborhood, but Chicago is a big city, and there's opportunity all over.
Opportunity for Slim means taking the bus out of his neighborhood, 4 hours round trip sometimes, to work in a fast food place.
I don't stay in the city and say nothing for me because all the jobs are gone and that's it. If you go out and get it, it's there for you. But if you say, I'm stuck here with nothing, then that's what you're going to get.
People from the projects can tell you what nothing means. But when it comes to defining something, they get hung up.
There's a way in which, when you are born and raised in public housing, that you were denied the opportunity to realize certain aspects of life and life experience. Many of those things having to do with upward mobility of future possibilities.
Alfred Young teaches urban economic mobility at the University of Michigan. He says for young people in the projects, getting ahead is an abstract idea.
The only vision of someone who's come from their neighborhoods or neighborhoods like theirs and that has achieved success have been athletes or entertainers.
Wentworth Gardens is one of the few projects left standing in Chicago. A group of teenagers and young men are drinking beer and chilling on the curb. We asked them what they wanted to do with their lives, what they wanted to be.
I don't know.
I'm working on it. I don't really know right now.
I go to school.
Hoping for the best.
But I don't know what I'm going to do yet.
And that's the hurdle. For guys who grow up like me, like Slim, and like the young men in Wentworth Gardens, it's the ability to see that beyond the long odds of life in the hood, there's a world of possibility. In Chicago, I'm Sylvester Monroe for Marketplace.
Good morning.
We like to say in America that you can make it no matter where you come from.
Welcome to the Mobility Counseling Program. I'm Miss Johnson.
But Miss Shanette Johnson, the woman welcoming a half dozen people into the offices of Housing Choice Partners in downtown Chicago.
You're welcome to get coffee and donuts.
Miss Johnson has a different message, which she explains as she projects a giant map of the city onto the front wall.
First, we're going to talk about all of the polka dots on the map.
Johnson's mobility counseling workshop is based on the idea that the polka dot you live in directly affects your future success in life, your income, your health, the quality of your education, and that you can profoundly change all that just by moving to a different polka dot, one she explains with
good schools,
low crime,
jobs close to home.
Workshops like these help low-income families move to places like that with help from federal rent vouchers. That's why Crystal Stribling is here. She says she wants out of the neighborhood she lives in now.
I have a 12-year-old boy. I want him to be able to go outside without nobody trying to induct him into a gang and all that stuff because he's very smart in school, and I want him to be the next president.
The problem is Stribling isn't sure where to go. And that's where mobility counselors like Miss Johnson come in.
A lot of people are stuck within the four corners of their old neighborhoods. That's all they know.
Johnson says if you don't have a car, if all your family and friends have lived in the same place for generations, then even if you have the will to move, it can be hard to find the way.
For example, Garfield Ridge. Who knows what Garfield Ridge is?
She puts this to her audience and nobody answers.
Nobody knows what Garfield Ridge is.
So she points to Garfield Ridge on the map. It's near Midway Airport and starts singing its praises.
Now, in that area alone is 19,000 jobs, hotels, motels, Holiday Inns, TGF Fridays. So that's opportunity for us and our families to grow and prosper, correct?
Everybody's taking notes. Mobility programs have been around for a couple decades in Chicago and have spread to other cities. The big question now is, do they work? Can moving from one polka dot to another really affect a life down the road?
This is my backyard. It's real peaceful.
That's Saida Harris, 8 years ago, right after she moved from a public housing project in Chicago to a middle-class suburb where she didn't know a soul. She was 35, single, and had just given birth to her fourth child. In the tape, you can hear the baby cooing in the background.
I didn't want another generation of my family being stuck. I wanted them to strive for much more.
I recently tracked down Harris and her family again.
Hi.
They live in another Chicago suburb now. And that little baby, she's old enough to introduce herself.
Tanaya.
And what grade are you in?
Second.
Tanaya has had a very different childhood from the rest of her family. She knows her brother and sisters grew up in a poor neighborhood. She's visited it a few times.
They shoot there and their boys' pants go down. They're sex.
And they don't do that here?
Uh-uh.
Tanaya's older sister, Naosha, was in middle school when her family moved. Now she's about to graduate college with a double major in business and education. She might be exactly where she is today, even if she'd never left her old neighborhood. But sometimes she wonders.
I just see the people I actually grew up with, like when we go back. And it's like, oh, wow, if I was still here, like would I have a baby like they would or dropped out in high school like they did? I'm just really grateful that I did have opportunities.
Opportunities and new expectations. Naosha says at her old school,
I was student of the year every year. It was no competition. And then it's like once I moved, I wasn't student of the year anymore. Like I had to actually work hard to get back to where I was.
It uncovered abilities that people didn't know they had.
James Rosenbaum is a sociologist at Northwestern University. He says mobility programs don't always work out. Some families face isolation or discrimination in their new neighborhoods. Some move back to their old ones. But Rosenbaum says geography clearly has some real power over destiny. He's tracked hundreds of families who've moved from Chicago housing projects to remote middle-class suburbs and compared their kids years later to the ones who'd stayed behind.
They were more likely to graduate high school. They were more likely to go to college. If they didn't go to college, they were more likely to have a job. Down the line, really big improvements.
Still, you might ask, instead of uprooting people from their neighborhoods, why not invest in those neighborhoods and bring more opportunities to them? That's important, Rosenbaum says, but it also takes time. And kids grow up fast. In Chicago, I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Down at the shore, everyone agrees. The fire rings on Orange County's beaches are a pretty cool place to hang out.
Well, I mean, we came out here to catch a few waves, and then later tonight, probably going to make some hot dogs over the fire pit.
Hot dogs and weenies and s'mores and just enjoying the beautiful day.
Connor Renard and Sarah Saldias say it would be a real bummer if someone took the fire pits away.
I don't know, it just kind of sucks.
The fire pits have been here for 60 years, but some residents of Newport Beach say that smoke from the fires is causing health problems. Dave Kiff is city manager of Newport Beach.
They have respiratory problems from asthma to some people talk about cancer, but it's difficult to pinpoint.
No one buys that. No one and their mother buys that.
OC Weekly editor Gustavo Arellano.
It's the elite who live right there at these affluent communities. They don't want the hoi polloi to come down here.
Dave Kiff takes offense to that.
They don't know what's in our hearts.
But Arellano says that Newport Beach has come up with many reasons to ban the fire pits.
There's just too many noisy teenagers there. People might fall into the fire pits.
Nobody ever wants to say those are people I don't want to be near.
Setha Lowe teaches anthropology at the City University of New York. She says that the rich and the rest often clash over public space. As the wealth gap grows, so will the problems.
If this continues because we have a greater difference between poor and rich, that means that more and more people are being thrown off public spaces that were actually public.
California officials are also divided. The Coastal Commission says the fire pits are a free resource for all beachgoers and should stay. But the regional agency that monitors air pollution says Newport Beach has a case. They've proposed a ban on fire pits in all of Southern California. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
So it's about 4:30 in the morning out here in Chicago. We are standing outside of a white van, and it's freezing outside, so most of the people have already taken a spot in the van.
The passengers are all Latino. Many are undocumented. They're headed to minimum wage jobs in the suburbs. They'll pack stuffed animals at a warehouse 40 minutes away. One of the nation's biggest temp staffing companies signs their checks, but recruiting the workers and transporting them to the job site, that's handled by an underground labor broker called a Reitero. In our investigation, we found that the Reiteros control access to work from beginning to end.
There's lots of work at Fresh Express, packing lettuce, men and women. Be ready at 5 in the morning.
That Reitero lists the available temp jobs on his outgoing phone message. And even though it's against the law, some Reiteros charge workers a fee to fill out a job application, like 20-year-old Maria Martinez.
For the application, I had to put like $4.
Many workers don't have cars, so they depend on the Reitero to get to and from the job. But that can be a scary proposition. I asked a small, middle-aged worker named Estella if she has confidence in the drivers.
The drivers drive very crazy. Sometimes they drive at a very high speed. It is not safe.
She says some drivers even drink on the job. Drivers are supposed to have a commercial license. Many don't have any license. Take this driver.
Tiene una licencia para manejar.
Sí tengo, pero no la voy a sacar.
He said that he has a license, but he wouldn't show it to me. The rides are the main way that Reiteros make money. The Reiteros charge $8 a day for a ride round trip. That's a lot for temp workers who make just over $8 an hour. And workers say if you don't pay for a ride, the Reiteros won't find you a job. Employment lawyer Chris Williams represented a guy who lives in Joliet, south of Chicago.
We had a worker who went to a staffing agency, was told, no, if you want to work at this staffing agency, you have to drive up to Chicago, go to Little Village, and meet at someone's garage. He went there, he waited, he got on a van, and they drove him back to Joliet to a factory to work in Joliet, Illinois. And then at the end of the day, he had to drive back in the van and then get back in his car and drive back to Joliet. And he had to pay for the ride in order to do that.
Williams says forcing temp workers to pay for rides is illegal under Illinois law, and if the money for the ride is deducted from a worker's check, forcing the pay below minimum wage, Williams says that's illegal too. It's Friday evening in Little Village, the end of a long week. Workers come here to 26th Street, where Reiteros distribute paychecks at check-cashing stores. They're charged 1-2% to cash their checks, and sometimes they're even cheated out of the change.
They keep all the pennies.
Many workers say they've been ripped off for more than pennies, getting cheated out of the hours worked. I found 20-year-old Maria Martinez selling fruit from a food cart on the sidewalk. She used to work with the Riteros until she didn't get paid.
They just had us back and forth going to the office and to the Ritero, and that was it. And your money, they didn't give it to you back.
So how much money did you lose?
300, which is like a week of work, 40 hours.
They didn't pay you?
No, they didn't pay me.
I spoke with Eugenio Aguilar, the Ritero Martinez blamed for her missing check. But Aguilar says any missing payments are the result of a clerical error by the temp staffing agency.
The companies use a supervisor. Sometimes the supervisor forgets to record the names of the workers. That's why sometimes they don't get paid.
I met Aguilar in front of his apartment building. Nothing special for a little village. I asked him if he's getting rich as a Ritero.
No, just enough to eat.
I met another Ritero at this church in a two-story brick building in a residential neighborhood. Bertin Salgado is also a reverend. He says he doesn't get any money from the staffing agencies.
The temporary staffing offices don't even pay me anything. Sometimes they don't even know me.
Salgado sees himself as helping the community.
El Ritero existe porque es una necesidad.
He says the Ritero exists because it's a necessity. Several workers I interviewed said the same thing. Without the Riteros, they say, who's going to hire a middle-aged woman with no education, no car, and no ability to speak English? The Riteros represent their lifeline to employment, though it comes at a big price that they can't avoid paying. In Chicago, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The beginning of these two women's tornado stories are alike. They were each home alone, each in the same neighborhood, a few blocks from where Plaza Towers School collapsed. And listen to how they each describe the tornado's approach.
It sounded literally like a freight train running over my shelter.
That's one of the women, Cindy. Here's the other, Michelle.
I lived in New York City, so I've heard the trains and the subways. It is a little bit like that sound.
Now here's both of them.
In the middle of the freight train sound, there was a shrill whistle.
Whistle of the air going through the walls themselves. You can feel
closest I can get is.
When Cindy climbed out of her underground storm bunker and Michelle crawled out of her closet, they each found their homes obliterated, reduced in a word to
nothing.
But nothing, it turns out, is a relative term. Let's start with Cindy, Cindy Beam. You get a sense of what nothing really means for her when you go to the site of her former home, which is now a concrete slab with a crumbling chimney surrounded by piles of rubble.
Pardon the mess. A tornado just blew through here.
Everybody's got an excuse, you do.
For one, she still owns her sense of humor. And she still owns the property underneath this rubble, which her insurance adjuster has come out to inspect. Cindy's had a good job for years, $20 an hour, and her house was fully insured. So she should be able to rebuild and replace most of her possessions. But first, she has to itemize them all.
Do you have any idea how many windows you might have had?
From her windows to her TVs to what she calls her one luxury item, her hot tub. Cindy's found a few precious things in the debris. The box with a lock of her late sister's hair. A bookshelf of Star Trek memorabilia.
I used to go to some of the conventions. I have a lot of the autographs and tech manuals for the ships and stuff.
Thanks to an advance from her insurance company, Cindy's already replaced her crushed Toyota with a new one, burnt orange for her home team, the Texas Longhorns. But it's drawn stares at disaster relief centers, so she taped a sign to the back.
It says, don't let the new car fool you. Everything I own fits in it. I survived F5. Praise God in all things.
We love you and we thank you in Jesus' name and all God's people say.
Cindy says her church has been a refuge. Church friends have given her gift cards, offered spare bedrooms in the short term. As for the longer term...
Hey, Lynn.
Her friend Lynn calls to say her family has a house they're putting on the market and Cindy can stay there while she's waiting to rebuild her own.
And I don't know, we hadn't talked rent or anything. I mean, I can help in.
We just want to help you, and if you want to help, you know, we'll figure that out.
Cindy says losing almost everything has made her realize how much she still has.
Even though I'm homeless, I'm in a much better position than a lot of other people right now.
Now let's turn to Michelle. Remember, before the tornado, she lived in the same neighborhood as Cindy. Since then, she's been staying most nights in this Red Cross shelter in downtown Moore, where an old Jackie Chan movie is playing in the rec room. She's found a new apartment to move into, but it's not ready for another week. And in the meantime, her friends' places are small, no spare bedrooms, and hotels are not an option.
I'm afraid to spend anything. It's just like,
Even before the tornado, life was tough for Michelle. She asked not to use her last name because of an unresolved domestic violence incident a while back. She's supporting a child on her own with a job that pays $11 an hour. Now the tornado is another problem to solve.
This is a list, so I don't remember the important things.
Don't forget them.
Correct. So I can't put a simple phrase together.
The list includes things like drink water and eat snacks, things that seem basic but easy to lose track of when there's so much else to do. Michelle was a renter with no insurance, so when she's not at work, she's been making the rounds at tornado relief centers, baby in tow.
Don't eat your shoe, sweetie. It's dirty.
She's slowly re-getting the essentials, a car seat, a pack and play. At one charity booth, a woman hands her a $50 gift card.
Oh, wow, thank you.
Use that in whatever way you need to.
Baby bed. Out of the pack and play, into a baby bed. Step up.
She asks for the group's address to send thank you notes.
One day when I get back on my feet and stuff, I'd like to repay the agencies themselves, so when somebody else needs it, it'll be there.
A few days later, I find Michelle in the shelter, late at night, writing those thank you notes. She'd stopped by her old home that day to search for a few last things in the debris. She didn't find anything except some wind-stripped trees. But then she looked again.
One of the trees there has a green leaf on it. That little piece of green just stopped me in my tracks. I looked and was like, it's coming back.
She shook her head and said it again. It's coming back. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.